Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their work in some small weird way. And today, I'm really excited to have writer, producer, director Aline Brosh McKenna here. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here, bright and early. For those of you who aren't familiar with Aline's work, please let me give you an introduction. Aline began her screenwriting career in 1999 with her first produced feature, the romantic comedy Three to Tango, starring Neve Campbell. That film established her as a go-to writer of realistic drama and romance. She followed that film up with 2004's Laws of Attraction, starring Julianne Moore and Pierce Brosnan. But her best-known work came with the film adaptation of the popular novel The Devil Wears Prada, a modern classic which features one of Meryl Streep's signature roles as the imperious magazine editor Miranda Priestly, which will go down in history as one of the most iconic characters in film, not just romantic comedies, I would say. That year, Aline racked up a Writers Guild BAFTA and Scripter Writer Award nominations for the worldwide box office hit. I don't even know what the box office was, but it's huge.
I mean, it was like $350 or something, which is pretty big for a movie with like a $35 million budget.
Yeah, rom-com, that's big. Then came the worldwide hit and perennial wedding favorite, 27 Dresses, starring Katherine Heigl. Morning Glory came after that, starring Rachel McAdams and Harrison Ford. The Cameron Crowe-directed Matt Damon star We Bought a Zoo. And her adaptation of musical Annie was all in there. But in 2014, Aline added television to her resume when she co-created the critically acclaimed Emmy Award-winning comedy series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, on which she served as head writer, showrunner, and executive producer. The series just finished airing, actually, its fourth and final season on the CW. In addition to writing and producing, she also directed the finale episodes of all four seasons of the show, and this year directed the series finale. Aline now has film projects in development, so we go back to film, but you're also developing multiple TV shows. Plus, she's got a graphic novel named titled Jane, a contemporary version of the Jane Eyre story illustrated by Eisner Award-winning artist Ramon Perez, which received two prestigious Eisner Award nominations, including Best Publication for Teens. So what I'm saying is that my guest is one of the most successful and biggest selling screenwriters of all time for women, right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
I'm in the, you know, top 50 or something for women, or 30.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you can just be like, yes,
yeah,
that's true, instead
mm-hmm.
of like, oh, no, no, I look terrible today.
We all have to work on that.
I know.
Ladies, we all have to work on that.
Well,
when someone says, that's a great shirt, and you go, oh my God, this is like $16 at Target, instead of just going, thank you.
This is like me every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
A lot of ladies every day.
Oh, how do we? You'll give us tips for training ourselves out of it, I'm sure, as we go along. Today, the movie that you chose to talk about is E.T. Could you tell us a little bit about why you chose this movie?
Well, I'm not a big genre action lady. I'm not a big genre consumer.
Yeah.
I will be a person who will not see this Avengers movie. I will be one of the eight people who I probably won't see it, especially because my kids are now old enough that they go and see it, those movies by themselves. Like, I took them to see a lot of superhero movies when they were younger.
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up on those stories, and I didn't grow up with those ambitions. I mean, I grew up reading, you know, Bronte Sisters, Little House on the Prairie, Great Brain, Archie Comics, All My Children.
Yeah.
So I grew up on, like, stories about humans that didn't really operate with, like, world building or superpowers.
Yeah.
And so when I look at the sort of, but when I look at the list of, like, my favorite top 10 movies, E.T. is one of them, and I know it is a genre movie. It's an alien movie and has aspects of a horror movie. But, you know, to me, it's a family drama and a coming of age story and a story about, you know, a sort of a lonely child dealing with difficult family circumstances. And
mm-hmm.
so it came out when I was about 15, and it was not a touchstone for me at the time, because when you're 15 is when you sort of are like the maximum, like, skeptical of everything. And E.T. is the first movie that I can remember being heavily marketed to us as, like, with a lot of products.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the candy and the toys, and I
I remember Pizza Hut had something going on with
that. Yeah, there was like a lot.
Tie-in.
I remember it feeling like, oh, this is part of the corporatization of movies. And I guess I had opinions about that in 10th grade, as one would. And so I didn't really rediscover the movie until my kids came around. And you're always looking for movies to show your kids and hoping that they hold up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astonished at what a masterpiece that movie was when I showed it to my kids. Back to the Future, I would put in that camp as well, that just completely hold up. And then looking at them through the lens of a screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
E.T. is just beautifully, beautifully crafted. And then, of course, it's written by a woman. So I got very interested in that. So I tracked down the screenplay. And for many years, the screenplay is in my office. It's somewhere in a box somewhere, but for many years it was in my old office. And it's a beautifully written screenplay as well.
Wow. For those of you who haven't seen E.T., today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously. But this movie is very old, so just go and watch it. That shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. However, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch E.T. now, this is your shot. And now you're back. So let me introduce E.T. with a little synopsis. Written by Melissa Matheson and directed by Steven Spielberg, E.T. the Extraterrestrial stars Henry Thomas as young Elliot, a boy in San Fernando Valley who finds an alien hiding in his shed one night. The alien flees, and nobody believes Elliot, but he lays out some Reese's Pieces to try to lure the alien back to him. Elliot finds the alien is a cool friend, and he feigns illness to stay home from school and play with him. Then Elliot's brother Michael and sister Gertie get to meet the alien.
I'm keeping him.
What is it?
He won't hurt you, Gertie. He won't hurt you, Gertie. I'm not gonna hurt you. Is he a boy or a girl? He's a boy. Was he wearing any clothes?
No.
But look, you can't tell. Not even Mom.
Why not?
Because grown-ups can't see him. Only little kids can see him.
Give me a break.
The alien shows how powerful it is by reviving some dead flowers. Foreshadowing. Elliot gets psychically connected to the alien, demonstrated when the alien is at home drinking beer and Elliot begins acting drunk in school. And then when Elliot kisses a girl he likes in the same way as the alien just saw in a movie. The alien then dubs himself E.T. because he reads some comics and he's like, oh, I'm E.T.
E.T., can you say that? Can you say E.T.? E.T.
E.T. E.T., 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 be good.
Be good. I taught him that, too.
He learns to speak English, gets the idea to phone home, but also grows ill, which alarms Michael because Elliot keeps referring him to himself and the alien as the we. On Halloween, they decide to dress E.T. as a ghost and take him to a place to phone home. He succeeds, but E.T. is gone when Elliot wakes up. Elliot goes home, Michael finds E.T. half dead and brings him back to the house. So both Elliot and E.T. are on their deathbeds. And then the government comes in and sets up a hospital tent outside of the house where they take E.T. to study him. E.T. dies, apparently, but Elliot gets better, meaning that maybe their connection is severed, something like that. Elliot's left alone to grieve with E.T., but then E.T. comes back to life and says his family is coming for him.
E.T. phone home. Home.
Does this mean they're coming?
Yes. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home.
Elliot and Michael steal a van to escape with E.T. E.T. makes it to his spaceship. Elliot gives him the flower he'd revived earlier, and E.T.'s finger lights up, and he touches Elliot's forehead, gets on the ship, and leaves a rainbow in his wake.
Yeah.
It's a really simple story.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where when I usually read the synopsis of these movies, you know, for genre stuff, there's just a lot of moving parts.
Sure.
There's a lot of things happening.
Yeah.
But this is a really simple story.
Yes.
It's probably one of the easier synopses I've had to look at and
right.
write.
Right.
But
it's like a fable.
It is.
Yeah. And it has a timeless quality to it. And in many ways, it's a movie about a pet.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. A special pet.
There's a lot of ways that this can be interpreted, too. Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I wanted to get to first is something that you mentioned, where this is written by a woman, mm-hmm. by Melissa Matheson, really, really brilliant writer. And the idea that Steven Spielberg struck up this relationship with Melissa while he was working on Raiders with Harrison Ford, because they were together for quite a while. So the bonding of these two people came, quote, because Steven Spielberg, quote, said, "Between shots on Raiders, I would hang out with Melissa Matheson. We were turning over rocks looking for scorpions. Every fifth rock, a scorpion would charge and we would jump back and scream. It was terribly frightening. And I remember between thrills and screams and yelling through my bullhorn 100 yards away, I had time to tell Melissa most of the story. And at the end of the story, there was a tear in Melissa's eye. It was hot. It was dusty. It was broad daylight. I was amazed that anyone could sweat in the dry heat, let alone produce one tear. I said something like, 'Is something in your eye?' And she said, 'That's beautiful. That's great.' And I said, instantly, 'I'm very impulsive about these things. Would you write it?' And she said, 'No, no, no. I've retired. I'm writing something I've been working on for 8-10 weeks. I've hit a wall and I can't write anymore. I've got to get away from writing. I can't write.' It took me a week to convince Melissa to do the movie. I even worked on Harrison to get it." I thought that was a really beautiful way for this to happen and for him to really convince this woman to kind of come back and make this iconic movie that she was clearly capable of writing.
Yeah, he had been apparently thinking about it for a long time and sort of developing it. And one of the things I do remember about first seeing it is that it's about divorce. It deals with divorce.
Yes.
And I think that and Doubtfire were like two of the first sort of broad audience movies that I can remember where the family was dealing with divorce in a somewhat uncontrived way.
Less of a parent trap way where like, oh, of course they'll get back together.
That's right. And I know it came out in 1982, but in my mind, it's a 70s movie. It's on the pivot point from a 70s to an 80s movie, because in many ways it has that sort of organic, uncontrived aspect that we associate with 70s movies, but it's definitely pivoting into 80s where things became more commodified and more, lot more action and a lot less languorous than they had been in the 70s. And it is interestingly that, and I think that's what as a teenager I responded against a little bit, is that there is a lot of sort of conveniently propulsiveness to the storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
But of course now I really appreciate that and I appreciate all the bits. And it actually starts as like a domestic divorce drama, and you see that he is the sort of the picked on middle child, and or he feels that way and he feels comfortable nowhere and his dad's not around. And then there's a little bit of spookiness when he's sort of seeking out E.T. in the shed. And mm-hmm. then once E.T. comes into their life, there's about 30 minutes, which is kind of a sitcom.
Yes.
Where, you know, it's not Elf, but it's you know, E.T. living in the home and sort of affecting everyone and us understanding what his capabilities are. And then
for something like that, I would say a movie like that today, you might get an executive being like, can we move the story along
for sure.
here?
Definitely. And that's why I'm saying it's like in that interesting pivot point. One of the things I'm always interested in Spielberg as a filmmaker is that he actually goes to great lengths to be of the time. And I think, you know, if you look at Close Encounters, if you look at, you know, he was very influenced by the 70s and that aesthetic, and obviously all those guys were his buddies, De Palma, mm-hmm. and then in the 80s he kind of moved towards this more you know, propulsive action based and then he's gotten sort of more in the Fincher school of the, you know, interesting camera technique and darker and mm-hmm. And I think that's wonderful that he's able to sort of reflect the aesthetic of the time, and then but there's certain kind of hallmarky Spielbergery visual style that he has maintained through all those aesthetics.
Yeah, the iconic oneer that he does pretty consistently.
Yeah, but he, you know, he has an interesting conversation with the culture, because a lot of things he did influenced those filmmakers, and then he is also clearly drawing inspiration from those younger filmmakers as well. And so his work has a really interesting conversation with pop culture, and I really admire that about him, because I feel like he doesn't get calcified in sort of one aesthetic, that he's somewhat flexible.
Do you find that inspiring to you in a way? Because obviously what you've made is ingrained in the pop culture.
Some is and some isn't.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, some things, you know, and this is, you know, some things catch fire and some don't. And I think, you know, E.T. caught fire as a story, as a film that people admired, but as a, also very much as a pop culture, you know, again, flooded with toys, Pez dispensers, stuffed animals.
Weird, because that was like really the first time that that had happened. Kathleen Kennedy talks about how they didn't even think they were going to do licensing until all of a sudden there was a 747 jet coming in from Europe that had all of these knockoff toys of like dolls of E.T. And they were like, what do you want us to do? And she was like, I guess we have to get a copyright.
Well, also because there's that scene where he looks like a stuffed animal. So
yeah.
he's sort of, it's really interesting to do an alien movie where the creature is also cutified in that way. So it is like a pet.
Yeah.
Especially when you compare it to Close Encounters, which is very dark. I mean, also a marital drama in certain ways in dealing with family disruption, but is quite dark and also ends with someone going off to space. But it's a different, you know, it's a different, darker configuration. And so there was this kind of like bright commodity, go shop at the Kmart, although at the time it would have been like we would go to Corvettes or Caldors or whatever in the East Coast. So it's interesting that that's what I really perceived at the time. And now I can really perceive the craft and the screenplay. And it's written so soulfully and uncynically, especially when you read the screenplay, you can see that. And then there's just an enormous amount of technical work that went into making that movie and getting the creature right and getting the movement right and getting the makeup correct. And
yes.
And so it was an enormous technical enterprise. And I think also a good example of how Spielberg is, I think, particularly good at making those things seamless.
Well, I mean, talking about kind of like the technical things, I mean, what you do or what you've been doing for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is it's pretty intense, I would say. There's so much production involved,
yeah,
of rehearsal, of writing, of music, of everything. I'm surprised that you guys were able to finish it. You know?
Yeah, people are always shocked. We shot those episodes in 7 days, which is not a long time for an hour in general.
Yeah.
But for 7 days to shoot two or three, sometimes three music videos in addition to the regular scripted format, was insane. And we did it because we didn't know we couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was very production heavy. And there were definitely times where, you know, because my primary interest is character stuff and scene work, there were times sort of being on set and feeling like the production was as important as the emotional stuff, like making sure that it looked right and it captured the genre and it really, like, so that's less about sort of making sure that these two, you know, two, three, five characters, whatever, are kind of portraying emotion accurately. You also have to make sure that you're servicing the production side accurately. And I do, it's interesting you should say that, because musical comedy is a heavy genre.
Yes.
And so it was the most heavy genre I had to service. There was a portion of my career where I adapted a graphic novel called Rust, which is how I know the guys from Boom, which is how I ended up writing a graphic novel.
Oh, that's how you did Jane. Okay.
Yeah. And so I adapted, and the Rust book series is amazing, amazing. For those of you who love graphic novels, it's just incredible. Royden Lepp is the author, and it's gorgeous. So I adapted that. Joe Cornish was going to make it for a while. I wrote an early draft of Cinderella, which was very different from the film. It was like an adventure, origin story of a female knight, which is like, I don't know what I was thinking that Disney was going to do that. But for a moment, we thought that that's what we were doing. And then it became clear to them and then me, like, wait, what are we doing? And so I had a little period in there, and I was working a lot with Simon Kinberg, who does a lot of genre movies. And the Jane book is, it's sort of like a Hitchcock take on Jane Eyre.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I did write genre stuff, and it was interesting collaborating with Simon is more of a genre filmmaker. Obviously, JJ is too, but JJ and I worked on Morning Glory, which is quite traditional. But
yeah, he kind of does both, I think.
Yeah, he has a great love for character-driven pieces, actually. And so I worked on things that were more genre-based, and it's really what doing that stuff is, and it's very well done in E.T., is I think of it as math. Mm-hmm. It's architecture. It's, you know, constructing. You really have to get out your popsicle sticks and make sure that all of that stuff is really solid, because you can really bore and confuse an audience mm-hmm. with genre math. And you have a different challenge when you're doing a primarily character-based piece, which is to have enough infrastructure to keep you going mm-hmm. and not feel like that's really intrusive. And any movie like that I've written that's, you know, a rom-com or in a rom-com tone, you need enough structure to be moving you forward and to have some sort of, like, quote-unquote ticking clock, but you don't want it to be, like, sweaty or overwhelming mm-hmm. the story. But when you work in genre pieces, you need, you know, bigger. I'm producing a movie that is a police comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have bad guys, and you have to have surveillance, and you have to have a crime, and you have to do, and I think of all that as math. And, you know, when you're, if you're primarily a verbal SAT person, you know, you got to sit down and study your math SAT questions too. And I think in a lot of ways, the mark of a great genre movie is that you're not getting bogged down. I mean, I have a thing that my kids make fun of me, which is during a big action sequence in like a big action movie, I will fall asleep because I think it's like the bombardment of stimuli.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of movies where, like, you know, the minute they embarked on, like, because a lot of genre movies now, I've noticed, like, they end and then they start again. Like, the end of Act Two is usually, like, sufficient for me. Mm-hmm. Like, we could wrap it up. And then now there's such an arms race that Act Three, they're often like, okay, well, we've defeated the Act Two villain, but the Act Two villain revealed an Act Three villain.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have, like, a much more giant creature or a much more giant meteor or a much more, and it's almost like a little 20-page pornographic recapitulation of the first two acts. You mm-hmm. know what I'm, like, it's like a very big, super huge stakes wipe. Because, like, the stakes of E.T., even the stakes of Close Encounters or Jaws, it's like they're still personal stakes mostly, or just one town or one marriage or one family. But now the stakes in genre movies are massive towards the end.
Oh, yeah.
And usually when they, like, suit up to go do the very last thing, I fall asleep. And then I wake up for the parts that I love, which is, like, they beat the giant, you know, lizard, centipede, vagina monster, and then they're all, like, regrouping to do, like, the character summary where people go back to the... And I love that part. I always love the first 10-15 minutes of a superhero movie and the last, like, 8 minutes of a superhero movie, because I love the, like, setup and the epilogue.
I wish I'm excited for someone to make a little cut for you of Avengers Endgame that's just about 15 minutes long. We're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk about rewriting on set. We're gonna talk about slowing pictures down and Kathleen Kennedy and all a bunch of other stuff. Okay, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but, like, also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man, sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks every week. Myself, and I'm Morgan Rhodes, and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Aline Brosh McKenna, and we are talking about E.T. I would love to get into some of Melissa Matheson's process for writing some of this movie. You were talking about that 30-minute piece in the center where you just got the kind of like sitcom-ish thing that's happening. And I wanted to get into that and how Melissa Matheson crafts it, because, you know, Spielberg let her do a lot of interesting things on set. He's a very like flexible director. From every person I've ever heard who's worked with him, it's just like, oh, he's very flexible when it comes to the writing. And he said, quote, sometimes there was improvised dialogue. Melissa Matheson was on set every day and she'd hear them, the kids talking in between takes. She always carries this notepad everywhere with her and she'd go into a corner and write down what she heard. She would just eavesdrop on all the kids talking, end quote. So that's something really interesting that happened where, for instance, Drew Barrymore, just 7 years old when they were filming, they showed her the puppet and Melissa Matheson was just creeping around with her notebook. And Drew Barrymore went, I don't like his feet.
I don't like his feet. You only feet, you little twerp.
And she was like, yes. And then she wrote it in and that changed the
That's
script.
That's great. You know? I am very confused about why there isn't a writer on set of every movie. It's
right?
quite unusual, and I'm not sure. I think it threatens people. People find it destabilizing. They're afraid you're going to hold up the process. And I've definitely worked on movies where they were afraid that having a writer there that the director was going to want to talk to was going to slow things down. But it's such a, you know, you want to have that flexibility to adjust to what's happening on set. And that's one of the great joys of a television show is that you're shooting, writing, editing, you're doing all those things at the same. And so it's such an organic process of like being on set and being live in the moment and seeing what's happening and seeing what's happening among actors and mm-hmm. seeing what they're capable of. And, you know, I've been somewhat fortunate that I've been on sets of a few of my movies, not all. Some I'm more connected to than others.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I worked on Morning Glory, I was aware that it costs money to have a writer around.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the movie got greenlit, I asked my agent to ask them if they could put something in the budget to pay for me to fly back and forth or per diem or something, just so that I wasn't paying for all of my travel and onset stuff out of my own pocket.
Yeah.
And they called me back and they said, JJ's already put, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks of that into the budget because JJ came up as a writer and he knew he knows that they don't make those allowances. And I really was very touched by that. That's really stuck with me. And so having a writer on set is critical, and it leads to those a lot of those grace moments. So I was around for especially the prep stuff on Prada, and when I went to the table read and I realized that Emily Blunt was capable of doing what Emily Blunt was, and also she had not, that character had not been written to be British. And I sort of grabbed her and dragged her to a coffee shop and we went through the script together and she, you know, came up with little like customizations for herself and mm-hmm. we riffed on making it more Emily Blunt-y. And there's things in that movie where like she says, I'm hearing this and I want to be hearing this. And she does this gesture with her hand and that's just all Emily. And
mm-hmm.
that's one of the great joys of creating something is having those moments on set where you can create something. And directors who have writers around, I think, are the more confident ones.
Oh, yeah.
And so I don't totally understand why you wouldn't avail yourself of somebody who is a story expert. And that's what writers are. They're story experts and they're supposed to be truth experts in terms of detecting what's happening in a scene.
Mm-hmm. But you moving into TV, that
yes.
was an easier
Oh, yes. Well,
way
the TV is run by writers.
Yeah.
And so, and to me, you know, I've said this many times, but it's one of the reasons TV's so good right now is it's run by writers. Television is run and controlled by writers. The directors work for the writers. And writers are the ones who, you know, are the experts and authors of those stories.
Yeah.
And I think it shows. And I think a lot of the movies that we love, it's not an accident that a lot of them are writer-directors because that sort of, you know, that having the writer present on set, it just creates a different understanding of the script. And if a director is really, you know, stiff-arming a writer away from the material, I just think it speaks to a lack of confidence
mm-hmm.
You know, sort of a need to be in control over having, I mean, what a luxury to have someone whose custody of the story that you can turn and say, you know, is this right? Or what do you think of this? Or, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's not surprising to me that he found a lot of wonderful moments through working with Melissa.
Well, I think that one of the things that you can really track how this works back to is the fact that Spielberg said this was the time that he was able to figure out that commercial and personal could work together. And Kathleen Kennedy said he was coming off the blockbuster successes of Jaws, but Jaws wasn't a movie operating on a deeply personal level. And this was. So that was a surprise to Steven. I think that's an interesting and valuable thing for any artist, any filmmaker, certainly of Steven's status, to recognize you can still have commercial successes inside something that's very personal. I think even today that gets forgotten sometimes. People want to make a distinction between what's commercial and what's art. I think Steven, more than many, understands you can combine the two. And E.T. inspired a lot of that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of the Spielberg movies that I love the most are Lonely Children movies. I love Empire of the Sun.
Oh, God, that's so beautiful.
Yeah,
some early Christian Bale shit.
Beautiful, beautiful movie. And a lot of epic sweep to that, but also a lot of emotion. And that's a gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Spielberg is a filmmaker that remains very connected to his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's visible in many of the things that he's made.
For you, do you feel like you've learned the lesson that Spielberg has learned, that you can make commercial things that are also personal?
Well, I always did that. I always tell young writers, write in an identifiable genre so you have some guidelines to follow, and write a character that's more or less you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way you have fewer things to worry about in terms of, you know, creating your structure and creating your character. So all the first things I ever wrote, just the lead character, was basically me in mm-hmm. some situation. And the very first thing I wrote, the script that got me representation and that I sold and that sort of launched my career, was a sort of an 80s-ish cop. It was actually about a female IRS agent who goes to audit this guy, and he runs out of the house and his house blows up,
mm-hmm.
and they go on the road together, and then he disappears and she and her best friend try to find him. So it was like a sort of capery 80s, you know, Bird on a Wire-y kind
yeah.
of movie, but I just really made the lead character me, and it made it easier. And then I was watching a lot of like capery comedies, and so that you know, I've always done that, because I think it depends on what kind of writer you are. Like, I'm a voice writer. When I started, I had a voice more mm-hmm. than I had the like external understanding of structure, and that understanding of structure is something that I acquired.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about that is I have a lot of strength in that now, because I had to learn it. If mm-hmm. that makes any sense.
Yeah. It wasn't innate to you, and so you didn't get to be lazy with it.
Yeah, I had to really understand like what actually moves a story forward. And that's why the movies that I really admire are movies that have like really deft plots. I'm not usually a fan of like things happen movies where it's just like the atmo and the photography and the like vibey thing, but there's no story. I don't, I can appreciate those, but those are not the movies that I love and I study. I like stories, and I love well-structured stories. And that's partly because it's something that I admired and had to, learn, because it's really a discipline. I've actually never met a writer significantly under the age of 30 who had a really, really strong structural sense. It's something that you really have to learn by doing, because mm-hmm. it's really interesting that narrative is like one of the basic building blocks of human experience.
Yeah.
But most people don't know how to tell a coherent story, which is like, which, you know, if you've gone to a dinner party and someone starts talking about like, you know, dropping their kid off at college, and next thing you know, they're talking about Buddhist temples, and you're like, But we just don't have, it's really interesting to me that it's like such a fundamental, you know, we don't all know how to make fire, and we all don't know how to tell stories. Mm-hmm. They're all skills you have to learn. But I really admire deft storytelling, and E.T.'s screenplay is a really good example of that, where all the turn, you're allowed to settle into the story, but then it turns when you need it to turn. And mm-hmm. then it's a really good example of, you know, all movies, as Craig Mazin says on Script Notes, all movies are horror movies between 70 and 90, no matter what. Even Tootsie is a horror movie between 70 and 90 because it's all closing in on him and they've extended his contract and Julie's going to find out who he is. And E.T. is like a real manifestation of that because it really turns into like a sci-fi horror movie with like breathing tense and, you know, the visual aesthetic is different.
Yeah. This movie scared the shit out of
me. Yeah, me too.
I watched a lot of horror movies when I was a kid, and this was the one I couldn't finish. I was really freaked out.
Was it like Dead E.T. in the woods? But, you know, again, I was 15, so I was a little bit like, yeah, whatever. That's totally like a prop, guys. And it's there are a lot of movies that I watch between the ages of, like, let's say 15 and 22, you know, where that I had a 22 at about, like that I thought like, oh my God, guys, this is like so whatever. And that I have gone back since and watched and been like, oh my God, this movie is great and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, I'm parenting teenagers now and it is funny to see like there is something about mainstream culture that they find a bit corny and it's because things with mass appeal are corny in certain respects. But you know, so I remember it being like really shocking, though, like the images of a naked E.T. like almost drowned in gray in the river, like they were shocking. And
yes.
And then the thing in the hospital was quite in the makeshift hospital is quite
I remember like
upsetting.
The white kind of billowing tunnels kind of thing. And I was just like, oh, God, this is what death feels like. And I really couldn't handle
it. Well, and it's military imagery. It's secret military vibes.
Yeah, and I just wasn't prepared for that. I think it was because I was also very connected to the characters.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, one thing I recommend for everybody is to watch Henry Thomas's audition. You can find it online. And you can see Spielberg working with him. And it's really incredible. It's like the best audition you'll ever see. But it's also Spielberg working with this boy to really draw this performance out of him, and it's an incredible audition tape, and it's his performance is incredible.
Yeah, and that was one of the things Kathleen Kennedy said, that they chose Henry Thomas because of they watched Raggedy Man, and she said, quote, he was in Raggedy Man and he was yelling at Sissy Spacek and said, "You're not a mother, you're a telephone operator." I remember Steven and I watching that scene and going, wow, and we immediately brought him in and knew that he was so good.
Yeah, the audition is, you can see it. He's amazing.
Man, it's weird when like a child seems to know so much about, it's like a sensor or something like that.
Child actors are, a lot of it is instinct. And we worked with many wonderful child actors on our show, and a lot of it is instinct. And I think that he was so young then that it's a little bit less technique, and it's more just how comfortable a child feels playing pretend under the eyes of a bunch of adults in a very awkward, you know, non-organic situation.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll actually get a little bit more into how he was directing Henry Thomas and the kind of need for humanity on set. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And together we're the hosts of Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. What does that mean for you, the podcast consumer? Well, it means that you're going to get a lot of stories about how we used to do weird stuff to people in order to try to fix them.
Do you know that we used to think diseases were caused by bad smells? And that we used to eat mummies for medicine?
That's super funny. I kind of like it.
Well, thanks, and we hope you'll kind of like our show, Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. It's available every Friday wherever fine podcasts are sold, or at its beautiful, picturesque home at
MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Aline Brosh McKenna, and we are talking about E.T. I wanted to talk about how Crazy Ex-Girlfriend in particular and E.T. have something in common in terms of understanding the the dynamics of the valley or the suburbs.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Right. That's a good insight, yeah. I mean, I grew up in the New Jersey suburbs, and one of the reasons that I always connected to West Covina is that, you know, New Jersey suburbs have like, there's like a bunch of towns and they have unusual names, but they're sort of the same town. There's just sort of like one big sprawling town, and Southern California is like that too.
Yep.
We took great pains to really reflect the community in every way we could, and sort of the SoCal vibe and the hot sun and the specificity of that. I mean, E.T. also harkens back to a time when parents really did open the door and turn you out and you could just come back whenever. Mm-hmm. They're doing that at Halloween in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And kids now are just not growing up with that. They're just growing up with parents are much more present in children's lives now. The relationship between parents and children is completely different.
Yeah.
Spielberg was raised by, you know, a generation that had lived through tremendous world trauma, depression, and world wars, and so was I.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad just turned 90, and they're just the difference between a 50-year-old and a 90-year-old is different now. Between the difference between a 10-year-old and a 50-year-old is mm-hmm. completely different because, you know, members of my generation are, I mean, just, you know, look what we're wearing. Like, this isn't what, you know, parents were really a completely different planet
mm-hmm.
from children. And now, you know, your dad could easily have like a room filled with Star Wars collectibles.
Yeah.
So those generational things have changed. Not that to say that they're always for the better, but they have changed.
I think the thing that really gets me with the location, and I could say this for about both of your projects, E.T. and then also Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, has to do with the kind of the way that they exalt average places, but mm-hmm. also kind of explore the underbelly of them. Like mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg said, quote, "It's easy to notice strangers in suburbia because everything is equal. And it's very easy to notice a glitch. The smallest glitch is a spectacle in that kind of a trapped situation."
Uh-huh.
And I see Rachel's character as a glitch
right.
in West Covina. And
sure.
then E.T. is your glitch in
right.
E.T.
Although I would also, you could argue also that the little boy is a glitch too, because he's lonely, he feels out of place.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is that, you know, that I really appreciate and empathize that movie, and there's really just two female characters and they're not lead characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when in rewatching it, you know, women by and large learn how to take male stories and relate to them and
mm-hmm.
personalize them. And it's something we've always done and had to do, because if you didn't, you would struggle to find mainstream stories.
Yes.
And it's interesting. And I think, like, I really resonated to the, in rewatching it as an adult, to the mother and what she was going through and how she was trying to protect her children.
Which is Dee Wallace.
Dee, yeah. And it's interesting to me that, you know, most of the top, obviously, 20, 30 top grossing movies of all times, I mean, I think they would probably all have male protagonists, probably, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that female writers are often more adept and used to writing different types of characters. I think it's one of the female writers' superpower is that
mm-hmm.
you're able to write male character, inhabit male characters, because you've grown up absorbing male stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the male stories that I most relate to, another favorite movie of mine is Jerry Maguire, is, you know, a male story which is about vulnerability and otherness and having difficulty fitting in with
mm-hmm.
the norms. And my parents are immigrant parents, and I grew up in a suburb, and I never felt like I belonged there. And so in that respect, I think E.T. in a way is not as much of an outsider, because he's incredibly skilled and competent, and he
mm-hmm.
can, you know, heal things and make things and communicate. But Henry is the one who feels out of sorts and out of place and abandoned by his father. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was from an intact family, but I really, the presence of my parents, which is, you know, my mother was a hidden child from France, and my father, who was a, you know, Israeli, you know, born when it was Palestine and
mm-hmm.
fought in the war of 1948, their presence in the suburb was just I always felt like we stuck out like sore thumbs. Mm-hmm. And I love the, you know, his character, Henry's character is alienated.
Yeah. You're hitting on something that, you know, a lot of people do gravitate towards and, you know, women love in these characters is it is vulnerability, which you mentioned. And, you know, Melissa Matheson writing this character, I think, you know, there doesn't seem to be a concern necessarily with masculinity or what this boy will. There's the one piece that you can get is the recreation of the Maureen O'Hara and John Wayne kiss from
right,
the movie.
Right.
You know, this kind of like grand romantic gesture and something like
and
that.
And Key is Peter Coyote's character is sort of featureless. You don't really know who he is or what he wants. He's literally a disembodied synecdoche of, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that that's the paternal figures in this movie are quite absent. And the older brother's like kind of a jerk to him in the beginning, but, you know, comes around and becomes an ally towards the end.
Yeah, he's sweet and he's, you know...
Ultimately, he's completely on his side.
Yeah, he becomes less about bullying and then that kind of trope wears away.
Right.
So there's a humanity.
Yes.
And I do wanted to talk about the kind of humanity that Spielberg brought to this movie, because I've got a great quote from Kathleen Kennedy. She said, "I think many of the stories Steven tells are father-son issues. I think that's something he often finds compelling, the dynamic of those relationships. And I think any time you find a way to explore those types of relevant relationships in any story, whatever the size of the backdrop, it's a more successful movie-going experience. Storytelling has always been at the forefront of what he's trying to do. Even looking at the Jurassic movies, I have to remind people there are about 80 dinosaur shots in the first Jurassic Park. Now it seems to be some sort of contest, and unless you have 2,000 effects shots, you don't have a tentpole movie. But I think that's completely wrong. Audiences still crave storytelling."
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of the summation of a lot of the things that you've been saying and through this talk.
Yeah.
That there's...
I miss the 70s movies that some of the filmmakers who are now making these super huge blockbusters, I miss the other movies they might have made. You know, it used mm-hmm. to be like, if you look at Sidney Pollack, you know, who's making Out of Africa and 3 Days of the Condor and Tootsie and, you know, just every kind of genre. And you know, now once people get on that conveyor belt of making these huge movies, they're less likely to step away and make a smaller character-based movies. And I do mourn a little bit the movies that we could have had if the mainstream movie business was not so dedicated to hugeosity.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting those more intimate stories on television.
Well, I mean, do you feel like your future is more in television than you feel like it is in movies at the moment?
Well, there's a big disruption in the business right now because of streaming movies on streaming.
Sure.
And it's funny, as a female filmmaker, you know, you're always saying to people, I know there's an audience for this. I know people are going to want this.
Mm-hmm.
And every time a Girl's Trip or a Mamma Mia or Devil Wears Prada becomes a hit movie, it's like everyone's shocked. But what's cool about Netflix is that they have the numbers to show that women are hungry and dying, or not just women, but people are just hungry and dying for different kinds of stories. Then,
yeah. I wish they would release those numbers, though, so that studios might know.
Right. But I think you're seeing that, like, that's where rom-coms are going to live now.
Yeah.
And they're not musty, dusty old rom-coms. You know, there's... they're making cool ones. And
oh yeah, we just had someone
she's
great.
She's amazing. Yeah.
Just
and that,
came out
I love and... that movie. I love the aesthetic of that movie.
Yeah.
And it feels contemporary and it feels fresh and it doesn't feel, you know, artificial. So I think you're going to see more films, on streaming platforms. And, you know, I always hope that the mainstream big movie business is going to notice and make those movies and put them on big screens, because I think everybody who writes movies really did grow up wanting to, you know, have them be on a big screen with somebody with a tub of popcorn. And so,
yes,
but I, to be honest, like, I don't really care so much if someone's watching it mm-hmm. in their home, as long as their TV doesn't have motion smoothing, then I don't mind so much. And I feel like as we've discussed, like, the demands for a huge scale sometimes swamps movies that could have been more character based.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to maybe finish up our discussion mm-hmm. here with the idea of early successes, because Kathleen Kennedy, this was her first movie that she produced solo, and she was like, oh, shit, this is very successful. And obviously we know where her career has taken her. She's got a quote here that kind of says why it helped her later on her career having this early success. She said, I only thought about it much later. In retrospect, when I look back, it's interesting. And I don't know if you have this feeling. I think once you've peered at the top, you can go on with your life and your career. I never felt it was something I was necessarily striving for. It wasn't something I thought I needed. I had a glimpse of what that was all about. And then I realized the work that I was doing was much more personal. It wasn't about trying to get awards.
Yeah, I mean, she must be the most successful female producer of all time.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, looking at just amounts of eyeballs. I really admire women who came up in that time. That was a very difficult transitional time for women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just some of the great ladies of show business came out of that era and are that age. My friend Donna Gelati, you know, won an Oscar for Best Picture for Shakespeare in Love. And mm-hmm. she just produced the Oscars. And, you know, I really admire women who came up with that in that time and have persevered, because I know that they came up against obstacles that I can't even imagine. And I had a bunch of obstacles. And women who are younger than me are coming up in an era where, you know, at least some of the stereotype biases about who can do these jobs has been erased. But, you know, obviously we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
But I'm just can only imagine, you know, the challenges she's faced.
Do you feel, I mean, 2006 is when you had a giant blockbuster.
Yeah.
And then you continue the successes. But did that change your mindset?
Well, you know, the best thing about it is that it changes your access to wonderful people to work with. Mm-hmm. And that's really the case. Like, you know, I product came out and, you know, like I had a general meeting with JJ, and that's how I met Kinberg, and that's how I met a lot of people who really admired that movie and reached out to me. And, you know, and I was able to say, hey, I'd like to do a show with Rachel, who was not very well known. And it's a show I'm doing, and I'm doing it with this wonderful person. And let me introduce you to her work. And I had a certain amount of, you know, bicep that I could put behind that I didn't have earlier in my career. And
you get to be your own JJ.
Yeah, I get to push things forward and identify talented people who, you know, maybe would have taken them a little bit longer to break through, and, you know, just send an email that says, Aline Brosh McKenna here, and have someone email me back, which was not the case earlier in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nicest thing about it, is really being able to reach out to people that you think are talented. You know, for all the horrors that is Twitter, I have reached out to many women in particular through Twitter and had a coffee or a breakfast or a drink, or like just a way to connect and say, like, I know you and I see you, and if you need me and if you need advice and if you want to call me or be a sounding board or compare experiences. And I've met so many people that way. So that is the nicest thing about it. Truly, that has been the nicest thing about writing a movie that people, you know, remember and care about.
And, you know, that's going to affect the next projects that you have coming out. So where should we be looking?
I'm writing a movie for Netflix, and I'm going to direct and produce. I'm doing that with Jason Bateman's company. He has a wonderful partner, Michael Costigan, and we're doing that for Netflix. And then I have a couple other movie projects and a few TV projects in various states of development. We wrapped the show about 2 months ago, and I had already set up the movie, so I went right into writing the movie. So I'm
no downtime.
Yeah. Well, though, screenwriting feels like downtime, because
showrunning
is insane.
Yeah.
Showrunning is the most wall-to-wall work experience you can ever have. And I did it for 4 years. So, you know, as a screenwriter, if you write for 5 hours, that's a good day. If you write for 6 hours, that's an extremely long day. So, like, I'm really back to what I did for 20 some years, which is like alone in a room. And it's nice. I miss the folks. I love the people that I made the show with. But it's nice to have that sort of quiet time as well. And then I'm developing, you know, a lot of things I'm developing are with other people that I love. And so it's fun. It's a it's a privilege.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your career and then also E.T. So
yeah, go watch E.T., guys. It's a good movie. You heard it here first.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Give me a break.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.